louder. I don't want to get that noise again. So if you haven't paid already, we've got Carla that is serving as our treasurer tonight. If you haven't paid her, please do so after the lecture. It's $5. Students with an ID can attend for $2, and we even go on the honor system on that. So if you don't have your ID, you're a student, you can still pay $2. If you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months for marking in the book, or you can pay $70 for a full year. And that breaks down to probably $3 a lecture or something like that. Pretty inexpensive. And also, just I want to remind you, if you haven't paid for your drinks and your food, please do so right after this meeting. We're a non-profit organization, so we're not in a position to pay for your food. And please be generous with your waste staff. We appreciate that. And all this information is available on our website, DallasFosterForum.org. And also, you can sign up to get updates on meetings through Meetup. And you can just probably just Google Meetup, right? And Carla,
there's a website on
Meetup Dallas Philosophers Forum, and you can get signed up for that service.
Philosophers Forum website, is it on Meetup?
You can get to it from there.
Okay. What was that? You can get to...
you can get to our website from the Meetup.
Okay, so you can get to our website from the Meetup right there. I also want to announce that beginning in the fall, we're going to move our time from 7:30 to 7 p.m. We polled the audience, and it seemed like there was a lot of interest in having time after the speaker to talk about the ideas and the discussion. And so the thought was that if we started at 7 p.m. and the speaker spoke for about 45 minutes and about 30 minutes for Q&A, which we typically do, then that would give us about 45 minutes for people to continue the conversation, continue to ask the speaker questions one-on-one. And so we'll start that in the fall, start at 7 p.m. Okay? So our speaker will, tonight, we'll be speaking for 45 minutes, and we'll open it up to Q&A. And then one last thing I just want to mention, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Dr. John Sandler is a professor of medical ethics at UT Southwestern Medical School and is the director of the program in ethics and science and medicine at the university. Dr. Sandler is co-founder and treasurer of the Association for the Advancement of Philosophy and Psychiatry, an organization dedicated to exploring conceptual issues at the interface of those two disciplines. And he's also on the executive board of the International Network of Philosophy and Psychiatry. He'll be speaking this evening on comparing sources of truth in criminal law and medicine. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. John Sandler.
Thank you. Is this working all right? It's coming through?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. If you'll abide me, I'm going to use my reading glasses for my small print. I was trying to keep everything on as few pages as possible. Before I get into my talk proper, let me just tell you a little bit about what I do. In addition to sort of my paying job and doing medical ethics, in fact, I was called with an ethics consult call just before a few minutes ago. I have had an interest in using philosophy as a tool to address some of the conceptual issues in psychiatry. And this has taken me in a variety of different areas. In the 90s and into early 2000s, I worked on a big book called Values in Psychiatric Diagnosis, where I sort of systematically worked through the various kinds of value judgments and commitments that are made in psychiatric diagnostic categories. As well as looking at the values that drive decisions in making the official diagnostic manual that the American Psychiatric Association uses. It's called the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. As a result of that work, I got interested in the relation. I noticed that too many of the mental disorders in the DSM had particular kinds of value commitments implicit in their diagnostic descriptions, and the particular ones I was concerned about had to do with what I would call wrongful or moral value judgments. That is that psychiatry, so psychiatry's categories mix up the idea of wrongful or immoral conduct and illness or disordered experience and behavior. And so that inspired me to work on my current project, which is a book called Vice and Psychiatric Diagnosis, where I sort of systematically work through not only the reasons why psychiatry has vicious categories, vice-laden categories, categories having to do with wrongful and criminal conduct, as well as more conventional medical categories that have to do with disability and impairment, like we have in ordinary or general medicine. So I'm going to be presenting a small piece of the Vice and Psychiatric Diagnosis book today that focuses on the kinds of approaches to truth in criminal law on the one hand, and then particularly in psychiatry on the other, and to a lesser extent medicine, because a lot of psychiatry depends on medicine. Broadly conceived. So now I'm to my outline. The first section that I wanted to talk to you about is introduce this idea of folk metaphysics. And so I'm sure those of you, you know, this is a philosopher's group, and so I'm sure you've had many speakers come and talk about philosophical metaphysics. Basically, how we know things and how the world is, the nature of existence. That's not what I'm going to be talking about today. I'd like to suggest that we have certain, ordinary people have certain assumptions they make about how the world works and what the nature of human existence is and how we know things. And what I'm calling this, for the purposes of this talk, is folk metaphysics. So I'm not going to be talking about Wittgenstein or Heidegger. I'm going to be talking about the ordinary beliefs that have been handed down to us through our culture, in our case, Western culture. So these metaphysical aspects of ordinary talk are often couched in terms that are familiar to us. So, for example, we talk about human nature. And so when we talk about human nature, we're really talking about what in philosophy would be thought of as many aspects of metaphysical sorts of assumptions. A lot of the claims and made by various religions have to do with metaphysical beliefs, as I'm going to illustrate later. And virtually all cultures and subcultures have certain beliefs that of a metaphysical nature. Now, what makes folk metaphysics different than philosophical metaphysics is simply that folk metaphysics is not articulated and systematized in a way that a serious philosophical scholar would try to create a system of what the nature of human being is. So this folk metaphysics are something that we simply receive, and oftentimes these beliefs are taken for granted. And you'll get a feel for what I'm talking about as I give you specific examples. So in addition to philosophy, a number of social science and other related disciplines talk about these folk metaphysical beliefs. Anthropology being one of them, intellectual history is another one. Linguistics is another one, a fascinating book that was very influential to me by the linguist George Lakoff. It was entitled Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things. And what Lakoff does, there's an irony in the title that I encourage you to read. And what it has to do is that if with various third world or tribal cultures, particular one in Southeast Asia, I believe, that he referred to, had a metaphysical system in this, again, this primitive culture that lumped together women, fire, and dangerous things, and that's where the title comes from. So this is a nice, useful cultural example. It is that while when we say women, fire, and dangerous things are all the same kind of stuff, we go, oh, what is this? You know, that just sounds crazy. But that's the power of these folk metaphysical beliefs. And you'll see them in our own culture as I give the substance of my talk. So what I'm going to be talking about for the remainder is how our own folk metaphysical beliefs and assumptions contribute to particular conceptual difficulties where criminal law on the one hand and where psychiatry, my field, meet. And of course, the most common places where criminal law and psychiatry meet is what we call forensic psychiatry, where psychiatrists give expert opinions about, for example, whether someone is competent, a defendant is competent to stand trial, or whether someone is suitable for the so-called insanity defense, which I'll briefly be talking about. So, part two is the section on truth in your handout. And again, my apologies for not having so many. I'm delighted and chagrined that the turnout was so good for what could have been seen as a pretty obscure talk. What is truth is a fundamental metaphysical question. And again, it's not one I'm going to be exploring in any sort of systematic way. Rather, what I'm going to be doing is describing for you the sort of conventions about how criminal law, on the one hand, tries to get at truth in the criminal trial setting, and on the other hand, how psychiatrists and, to a lesser extent, physicians in general, try to get at what the truth of, in the case of their focus of interest, what illness or mental illness is. So I'll be doing sort of a comparative folk metaphysics of these two traditions. Everybody following you so far?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. So what I'm going to basically do is I'm going to basically describe a kind of clash of folk metaphysics that's really based in Western intellectual history. And in the next section, I'm going to give you a very, as I say, outrageously brief summary of how we come to have the full some aspects of the full metaphysics we have today. And so the basic idea is that we have a tension today in our folk metaphysical understandings of how the world works. On the one hand, we have a folk metaphysics rooted in the Judeo-Christian and in the Islamic tradition, a religious tradition that began at the birth of those religions and has persisted now into our present day. And on the other hand, starting roughly in the so-called Enlightenment era, in the 1500s, 1600s, that was the birth of a new way of understanding the world, a scientific way of understanding the world that was explicitly secular and actually rejecting of these religious beliefs. And nevertheless, these two traditions are still at work in our culture today. As I'll point out later, this is sort of the genesis of what we, a lot of people, journalists, call the so-called culture wars. So, with that sort of setting, I'm now going to talk a little bit about this outrageously brief intellectual history of Western folk metaphysics. If you look at prehistory, and so we're talking about before there was recorded history, before there was BC, and we have very interesting beliefs about, for example, the genesis of wrongful behavior and the genesis of mental illness. And the evidence for this is really pretty sparse. I'm talking literally about prehistoric men and women. And one of the fundamental cases of evidence for the notion that people were possessed by evil spirits and perhaps or toxic humors was the fossil evidence of so-called trepanation or trepanation. Anyone know what that is? That's cutting a hole in the skull to let out the evil spirits. And so there is fossil evidence of these fossilized skulls. And what's remarkable about them is this
very primitive neurosurgical procedure, the patients actually survived because the fossilized skulls show evidence that the skull was healing. So again, when skulls heal, the raw edges and the core, the marrow and so forth, gets covered over in the healing process, and then the skull is fossilized, is preserved. So trepanation is one of our major clues to how primitive humans thought about what sociologists today call social deviance, which could either be construed as mental illness on the one hand or criminal behavior on the other. So the earliest known moral codes go back to the Code of Ur-Nammu, which was ancient Sumerian. I'm not going to get into that. But also, again, in the Mesopotamia later, the Code of Hammurabi, where there are very interesting proto-laws that directed human conduct. And so they address things that we'll readily recognize today. For example, like civil disputes about ownership of property, and even there's an aspect of what we today we would call criminal excuse, excusing someone who act out of passion or duress and harmed another person. The Code of Hammurabi has a way of dealing with those sorts of disputes or dealing with others. On the other hand, there was a perhaps more darker tradition, which you're familiar with, so-called lex talionis, the eye for an eye. The idea is that if I injure you, if I injure your eye, then in recompense, you know, the society, you're permitted to take my eye. It gives a very an ancient basis for our current policy of punishing wrongdoers and causing them harm that persists in today with the idea of criminal justice, which we take for granted has to do with inflicting punishment and suffering on the offender as, again, some sort of recompense. At the same period, there are ancient writings in the form of tablets or stelae, you know, these sort of big rocks that have crucial messages inscribed on them that established the early idea that bizarre experiences, disconnection from others, hearing voices and so forth had to do with being possessed by the devil or were a result of divine intervention. That is, that the gods were punishing the sufferer of mental illness. So again, that's prehistory. By the time of Moses and then later Jesus, a different set of folk metaphysics came into play, and in some ways a more systematized one. And I'm on page 2 now, at top. And so the basic idea of Judeo-Christian and then later Islamic folk metaphysics is that as far as moral conduct is concerned, what's expected of us as individuals if we are to achieve salvation is for us to be, first of all, personally responsible for our behavior. That salvation depends upon the individual, and that indeed punishment is issued to the individual. Now this is quite remarkably different than then and now in tribal cultures, where there's a collectivism in terms of moral responsibility. So for example, even in Navajo Indian tribes today, not only is moral culpability or blameworthiness inherited by families or sort of owned by families, that there's a syndrome that's of great psychiatric interest, although it's rare and idiosyncratic to the Navajo tribe, called ghost sickness. And Navajo ghost sickness betrays this idea of collective morality, because an individual can have these various weird psychiatric symptoms and hearing voices and being tortured and punished by ghosts. And they're ghosts that of the patient's own family that are deceased, their ancestors who committed moral wrongs in their lives, which are now being the punishments for their ancestors' moral wrongs are now being imposed on the patient. And so obviously the intervention for Navajo ghost sickness involves a tribal collectivist and a traditional healer in order to intervene. Does that make sense? So so this idea of tribal collectivity got rejected in Judeo-Christian and later Islamic ethics, and the idea that the individual could be saved and that the individual should be punished. The second element of Judeo-Christian folk metaphysics has to do with faith, that one is expected to have faith in God, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on because it's not that particularly relevant here. But what is particularly pertinent, which I already alluded to, is the idea of desert, or that is that people get what they deserve. And so this idea of if you act wrongly in your life today, either that will come back to you and you'll be punished by God in this life, and if not in this life, then certainly in the next one. So this idea of desert is very powerful. And as I'm going to explain later, this became the metaphysical background for early English common law and indeed our criminal traditions, the folk metaphysics of criminal law today, particularly here in the UK. Now, the other element that particularly Jesus Christ brought, with probably nicely illustrated by the Sermon on the Mount material from the New Testament, is this idea of good works and that one should model oneself after Jesus' actions. What's interesting in reading theologians in preparing this work is that Jesus didn't really articulate an ethics in the way that philosophers articulate ethics, that is, principles of living. What Jesus did was live a moral life which others, his followers, were expected to follow. And so people were expected to follow Jesus' example, which I would imagine many of you, even if you're not Christian, are familiar with from your own cultural learning. Now, this idea of doing good works and doing good and being good pointed backward to classical Greek virtues articulated by people like Plato and Aristotle, notions of things like charity, courage, and so forth, listed in your handout. So at this point, now we're well into the AD era, and these various religious traditions were elaborated. Probably I should mention briefly, I think it's a very powerful moment in Christian theology, was Augustine, or St. Augustine, his articulation and sort of promulgation and popularization of original sin. And it's the idea is that people at core are sort of metaphysically bad, and that faith is in practice and discipline, Christian discipline, is required in order to overcome the intrinsic badness of people, and that evil lurks within all of us. An idea that has persisted even, you know, into the 19th century with Freud, the idea of the id. Does these irrational bad things and gets you in trouble. So that's another part of our sort of folk metaphysical culture. By the time we then get into the 1500s and 1600s, this is a period following the Catholic Church, and the fall of the Roman Empire, Catholicism had fallen into a sort of decadent period, things like I forget what the term is, somebody can probably fill in, you pay
indulgences,
you pay your way into heaven, this sort of corruption, financial and otherwise, generated sort of the Protestant rebellion, Reformation, and the differentiation of Christian thought into the various sects that we know today.
Sects,
not sex. And it followed by the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment was in some ways a rejection of this idea of faith and this idea that humans were intrinsically flawed or evil, and that indeed if one followed reason and pursued secular truths in the form of science, one could achieve a better life. And so this splitting of Western culture into faith, from the faith-based folk metaphysics of desert, free will, individual responsibility for choices, and then into the world of secular science, has now set the stage for the kinds of conflict between scientific psychiatry and medicine and common law, and now criminal law later, that is based on religion. The other interesting thing about the Enlightenment is it was promulgated by intellectuals of the time, people like John Locke and Thomas Hobbes and so forth. And these individuals thought that really developed a psychology and articulated psychology about how people worked and how the mind worked, and develop new ways of thinking about how the mind worked that were different than the old faith folk metaphysics. And what was interesting to me is that the original Enlightenment philosophers that developed these views about human psychology, like Hobbes, Locke, David Hume, there was not a lot of work articulated on the psychology of morality, which in contemporary philosophy now is called moral psychology. And instead, the Enlightenment philosophers focused on what is usually attributed to Immanuel Kant, the idea of faculty psychology. In psychiatry, the faculties from Kant that have come to be the most influential are cognition, that is sort of the idea of motivation, affection or passions, emotions, and cognition, thinking and reason. So the early psychiatry that was influenced by this faculty psychology tended to organize their categories of mental illness, or what we call psychopathology, in terms of these faculty psychologies of emotions, thinking, and motivation, and these traces are still present in current psychiatric diagnostic categories. Interestingly, they didn't talk about the early psychiatrists and the early faculty psychologists in philosophy, didn't talk too much about the psychology of morality, and that's because at the split of the Enlightenment, morality was left to religion, and law, and the other three faculties, cognition, affection, and cognition, were then taken over by science, medicine, and what came to be known as psychology. Now, the other interesting trend is that these folk metaphysics have always been promulgated by elites.
I've already mentioned the Enlightenment elites. These were the wealthy, the landed gentry, the aristocrats, these philosophers that promulgated these ideas. But it was then the church leaders who then advocated for and tried to preserve church power through their own elite structures. And, you know, as we sit, as you know, right now in the birth of the next pope, so to speak, those traditions are still very much alive today. So what we're left with then, again, in the Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment era is British common law, which depicts then and now depends on these concepts of free will. That is, law today assumes that if you commit a wrongful act, that you're responsible for that, and that indeed you should get what you deserve, that is, some sort of punishment. So those.
Devil made me do it.
Well, I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to the devil making me do it. And of course, the devil did make you do it ever since Augustine. So those sorts of ideas of free will, desert, individual responsibility rather than collective or other complex sorts of causality that philosophers of science talk about today, those things persist in common law, and our legal structures are built around those concepts. In the meantime, the differentiation of the sciences from physics, molecular events, subatomic events, into what came to be known as psychology later, getting into the 16th and 17th century, sociology still later into the 19th century, anthropology, and then of course all of the so-called natural sciences, chemistry and biology, and sort of the biological understanding of the human being at birth, modern medicine. All those ideas were dependent on a whole different set of assumptions. First of all, especially as we head now into the 21st century, contemporary scientists, neuroscientists, sociologists, psychiatrists, if they haven't outright rejected the idea of free will, they're very skeptical about it. And so there are some free will apologists. There are people who say, well, free will is sort of an antiquated notion, and then there's this, I would probably remember myself as one of these, is that free will really needs to be re-understood and re-described as a very complex kind of causal relationship. That is, contemporary science thinks of events happening because of complex inter-level causes, that molecular events occur, interpersonal events occur, social events, political events, all of these have interrelated complex causal relationships that can reflect adversely. So for example, if there are toxins in our water supply that because of social neglect, they get into our drinking water, into our systems, and then disrupt the very cellular, subcellular, molecular equilibrium in our brains or other parts of our bodies. So all of these, for contemporary scientists, all of these sorts of causal events are interrelated. And so instead of having the notion of culpability or blameworthiness, we have this sort of complex, multi-causal, multi-level view of explanation. So where free will fits into that, if it does at all, is yet to be determined. And regardless of whether it can be resuscitated or not, it will be very much a different concept of free will than we've classically considered in prior centuries. Okay, so that's all the background. So now what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about doing this comparative analysis given these historical roots of psychiatry and medicine in secular science and the historical roots of common law and criminal law in religious folk, Judeo-Christian Islamic, I call it JCI in your handout, folk metaphysics, how those parse out in terms of the situation where we're trying to understand some kind of deviant behavior, and I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way, but behavior that's different, or in some cases, in criminal cases, that's antisocial or otherwise problematic. Before I do that, I just want to point H on page 2. One of the problems that emerged from Enlightenment science is that when we got into the social sciences, psychology, applied social science, psychiatry, sociology, anthropology, they really occupy an uneasy place because some aspects of social science have this sort of secular naturalism that I described, with this complex causality, and then other traditions in the social sciences have this sort of narrative individualism that's reminiscent of these religious traditions. And psychiatry particularly is one of those, is we're really mixed up in our field because we have all these explanatory theories about human behavior, not at all of which are on the same metaphysical playing field. So on the one hand, we have biological psychiatry, and we give medications for depression and for schizophrenia and have brain-based explanations for these conditions. And so we see them as naturalistic diseases, just like pneumonia or hepatitis is, that requires sort of biological intervention. And then we have very much alive psychotherapy traditions where we talk to people, try to assist them in their own self-understanding and reformulating new narrative understandings of themselves that are liberatory and help them recover to whatever their afflictions may be. So we sort of go this dance between secular naturalistic explanation and then sort of narrative individualism, free will sorts of formulations. So now I'm going to talk about truth as it's practiced in law, in criminal law, and medicine and psychiatry. Let's talk about criminal law first, on point A now. One of the interesting things when I started digging into this, I have some friends who are attorneys. They're academic attorneys at SMU. And I go, and so I just, in conversation, I ask him, you know, how do the courts determine what the truth is in, for example, a criminal case? And my colleague Tom Mayo, who's a SMU law professor, said, what makes you think that the courts are interested in truth? And what he meant was is that the courts are interested in justice, and they're not necessarily, truth and justice don't necessarily have to go together. And indeed, as I'll talk about in a minute, truth and healing don't necessarily have to go together in medicine. Lots of times I think people in medicine get better for the wrong reasons. That is that the physician's understanding may be erroneous, but the patient recovers nonetheless. And so there is a certain schism between truth and justice and truth and healing in both of these traditions. One question that the philosophy of law raises, which I'm not going to talk about, is truth necessary for justice? And that remains a hotly debated issue in philosophy of law. So I'm now on point C. I've already pointed out that psychiatry and medicine have this uneasy ground between JCI, free will, individuation, and the scientific naturalism.
And this scientific, this uneasy ground is one of the discomforts clinicians have in forensic settings. And to understand this, we should then look at then how truth is determined in criminal law. And this brings us to the so-called adversarial model, which, by the way, is an idiosyncrasy, relative idiosyncrasy of U.S. and U.K. English law. And so the basic idea is that the adversarial model is the procedure that generates truth in the criminal court setting. And you're very familiar with this. You know, in a criminal court setting, you have a prosecutor and you have a defense lawyer. And their respective jobs is to make the other guy look stupid and, you know, unprepared and unreasonable in order to convince the judge and or jury that they're right. And so the epistemic interest of the courts in this, the way to truth here, is if we have these two really smart people who are well prepared and have marshaled all kinds of evidence in support of their particular viewpoint, whether it's to convict or acquit, respectively, then the truth will emerge from that battleground, and the judge and jury will sit in judgment and determine that truth, which either results in the conviction or the acquittal. I note in number two, top of page three, that the adversarial model is both procedural and substantive. So in U.S. courts, the judge and jury are not involved in collecting and interpreting evidence. That's not the case in other European courts. In other European like the Netherlands or in France, the judge oftentimes is largely responsible for collecting the evidence. And the opposing attorneys are basically addressing procedural rules in the conduct of the court hearing. What's the legal scholar Ellen Sword had a very, I think, interesting formulation of the relationship truth or in the setting of the adversarial model. And this idea is that what the court wishes in order to achieve truth about the criminal case is that there be a congruence between truth and persuasion. And so for Sword, the way that we can be misled and find out falsities in the court, in the adversary process, is if, for example, the prosecuting lawyer is more skilled in elaborating and collecting evidence, is more rhetorically persuasive with the jury, and for reasons that have nothing to do with whether the defendant is guilty or not, manages to sway the jury, is able to persuade the jury away from the truth. And so for the pursuit of truth in the adversary model to work, there has to be a congruence that is truth and persuasion have to march together. And to the degree they fail to do that, then that poses problems. Now, what English and American common law has done to deal with this problem of this disconnect between truth and persuasion is to institute rules of conduct. And so you all have seen enough criminal court shows where, you know, the defense will object and will have a particular reason, and the court, the judge, will either sustain the objection or overrule it. That's one of the mechanisms that the judge attempts to assure the congruence between truth and persuasion. Another method is, in the United States, we have a very detailed set of rules called the Federal Rules of Evidence. And they basically govern what's admissible, what's usable in court, versus what isn't. And so the Rules of Evidence, again, aim to address
address these possible abuses and discrepancies between the adversarial model to assure, again, this congruence between truth and persuasion. Now, what's unique about criminal law compared to medicine is that criminal law has to come to a conclusion. That is, that there's a conviction or an acquittal, and there's no in-between. Now, there may be appeals, there may be court appeals, but even ultimately, there is a finite endpoint. The guy either goes to jail or he walks. It's just a matter of time. Now, I'm going to say later, that's in contrast to in medicine. The time the case ends in medicine is when the patient dies. And up to that point, the physician is continuously revising, reconsidering, amending, responding to new scientific evidence, offering new treatments. And so the truth is constantly being revised, refined, and changed up until the doctor-patient relationship ends in, you know, most dramatically in the patient, for that matter, the doctor's death. So, point six there on page three, criminal law generally is dependent upon individualism. We don't convict groups of people like in collective and tribal collectivism, right? We convict individualism. We count on, the criminal law counts on desert. That is, sentencing is is aimed to provide some punitive corrective to the offender's wrongs. Free will, again, we talked about, people are assumed to choose their actions freely, with occasional exceptions, which we didn't get into in psychiatry. And then culpability, which I'm calling the criminal event must have happened because of the defendant's action. That is, the defendant must be blameworthy. If the defendant had nothing to do with the criminal event, then the defendant has to be acquitted. So now let's contrast truth in medicine and psychiatry. Truth, like criminal law, also has uncertain status in medicine and psychiatry. Our priorities in medicine are very practical. We're much more interested in healing the patient than finding out some truth. Now, truth, it turns out, we think scientific truths could be really helpful. And so they're practically helpful. And it's not like medicine is about truth. Science is about finding out the truth about how the world works. But not medicine. Medicine is a moral task, a practical task aimed at healing the patient. And to the degree that we can heal the patient with truth, that's good. But we don't have to have the truth in order for the patient to heal. Truth is found in medicine and psychiatry in two fundamental ways. And so I've already sort of suggested this. So the physician, on the one hand, is trained in a body of expert knowledge that's generated by various sciences, whether it be biological sciences, molecular sciences, social sciences. They're a body of knowledge that they're sort of expected to memorize and then continuously update as new scientific knowledge is generated. Now, the problem and the limitation of that kind of scientific knowledge for physicians is that their scientific knowledge in medicine is based on populations of people. So we characterize, for example, patients with pneumonia having certain features, and once they make that diagnosis, then we study large numbers of those people to see what the common features are and how we can effectively intervene. We do that in psychiatry and all fields of medicine. Now, the problem is that we can say most people with pneumonia respond to cephalosporins, antibiotics, but we don't know if this patient, this unique individual, is going to. And so that's then the second source of truth that the physician depends upon, which is the interpersonal encounter and the securing of evidence about the patient through their history, through the physical exam, through laboratory studies that we offer. We then learn about the patient as a unique individual, and then integrate that knowledge with our population-based scientific knowledge. And putting those two together then gives us powerful methodological tools to helping heal that individual patients. And that then gives us, at least in principle, certain ideas or approximations to truth about what's going on with the patient's illness. The other thing I wanted to point out, the difference, this is, I think, point three here, is in the courtroom, in my book, I talk about the professional stage. And the professional stage is the trappings of where medicine or criminal law is performed and who's involved. And so, you know, the professional stage in criminal law from courtroom dramas, and you know the professional stage in medicine from medical dramas. And the professional stage of the courtroom is the judge, jury, the attorneys, the defendant, and then the audience. And so because of that large group of people who are involved in the criminal court, there's a certain theatrical quality. And indeed, philosophers of law talk about this theatrical quality. And it's the rhetorical skills, the persuasive skills of the attorney that prevail in convincing not just the jury, but actually the audience in the courtroom that their way is the right way. So that drama is played out in a very sort of dramaturgical way, in a way that medical practice is not. Now, lots of people are involved in medical practice, but when it comes right down to it, you go in to see your doctor, you close the door, and it's a tough discussion between you and her, between the patient and the doctor, and other people may come to be invoked, but the core essential element of the doctor-patient relationship is just that dyad. So while I would be the first to admit that there are theatrical elements to medicine, like the white coat, certain rituals that are performed, certain role expectations that the patient has of the doctor, and actually the doctor has for the patient. There's certain of these dramaturgical elements, but it's not nearly the severity and the intensity that it is in the criminal setting. So I've already sort of suggested that this folk metaphysics of contemporary medicine and psychiatry involves this scientific naturalism as well as this sort of narrative individualism. We have to understand the unique characteristics of the individual patient. And then I've argued that the truth of the medical inquiry is practical. If the dyad is correct, the patient, if we understand each other properly, the patient should get better or well, and within our limits of medical knowledge and therapeutics. So the truth of medicine and psychiatry is not dependent on free will, deserved culpability, or individualism. The concept of free will is not assumed in the development of disease. People, generally speaking, don't choose their diseases. People may engage in risk behavior that puts them up in probabilistic statistical chances of developing diseases more than others. Patients aren't assumed to get sick because they're bad people. So if our old religious ideas, people got sick or are mentally ill, they had a punishment from the gods. Scientific naturalism doesn't believe that. Patients don't get sick because of wrongful or immoral actions. Now, oftentimes we may couch them in this way. I mean, the classic example of people who think homosexuality is sinful and that AIDS, therefore, is, you know, the punishment from God. But that represents the holdover, not of scientific naturalism, but the holdover of folk-based, folk metaphysics from JCI. The patient is the individual, is the practical unit of truth. The patient may be sick because of water pollution, but the doctor is not practically situated to fix the water pollution. The physician can deal with the patient in front of him or her, but they're not going to fix the water, at least in this particular encounter. So individualism and the doctor-patient relationship is practical and not metaphysical. Um,
mentioned about death and that ending, the evolving truth in the physician's ministrations. So, in concluding, patients get sick under the medical, medicine and psychiatry viewpoint because of complex multi-level conditions, including things like genetic vulnerability, environmental conditions, upbringing, exposure to trauma, faulty neurotransmitter functions, lifestyle choices. I put in scare quotes because of the questionable status of choice in contemporary science. So I'm going to conclude briefly about how this really messes things. All these two metaphysical, folk metaphysical paths cause all kinds of problems in the criminal law and psychiatry relationship. In the criminal law setting, psychiatrists are not clear about what folk metaphysical stance they're taking in explaining defendants' actions. Hence, there's lots of disagreement in psychiatric expert witnesses about the insanity defense. And so the classic example in one of my books I talk about is the John Hinckley case. I see enough gray hairs in this audience to know who John Hinckley was. He was a young man, Highland Park, raised in Highland Park here in Dallas, who attempted to assassinate President Reagan, I don't know how long ago it was, the 70s. And was tried for his, you know, his wrongful actions, and found ultimately to be not guilty by reason of insanity, which actually generated an immense outcry against the so-called insanity defense. And if you look at the trial transcripts, there were two competing narratives from the opposing psychiatric consultants. One narrative described Hinckley's actions in meaningful, intentional, freely chosen terms, while the other one described John Hinckley's actions in the term that he was compromised by illness and was incapable of free choice. And it turned out, interestingly, speaking of the congruence of persuasion and truth, Will Carpenter was the witness for the defense who was much better at providing a narrative explanation for Hinckley's behavior. It was much more persuasive. His story was much more persuasive than Park Dietz, who was the opposing forensic expert, who in contrast sort of fumbled around with diagnosis and so forth and really didn't get the big picture about the narrative thrust of Hinckley's behavior. The court struggled with the problem of excuse, and a psychologist and attorney, Stephen Morse, has written extensively on this. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. And he basically says the reason people get off or get excused from criminal action is for two basic reasons. Either one, they're irrational because of some sort of mental illness. Okay. And of course, this then generates the question, what's rationality, which is another whole discussion. The second reason is that he calls it individuals face hard choices. And this is the example where the bad guy is holding a gun to your wife's head and says, I'm going to blow her brains out if you don't give me all your money. Okay. You refuse to give all your money and he kills your wife. And so then you're facing a hard choice and you'd be under duress, so to speak. And your whatever criminal behavior you might be accused of would be excused. But both of those ideas of rationality or hard choice, choosing between awful alternatives, are sort of situated again in the free will realm, which is where criminal courts are comfortable. And my B point, psychiatry is still figuring out whether we are on the job of taking care of sick people, that is a folk metaphysics of scientific naturalism, or policing morality and wrongful conduct, the folk metaphysics of JCI. So, for example, in the DSM, the official diagnostic manual of psychiatry, the different kinds of mental disorders, you've probably been reading about it in the paper, the DSM-5, and you know, everybody's upset about this. DSM-5, as well as the prior editions, had certain categories that are almost exhaustively defined by wrongful or criminal conduct. The classic example I like to give is this disorder of children called the conduct disorder. If you look at the diagnostic criteria of conduct disorder, virtually every one of them is a wrongful or immoral behavior or action. And there's really nothing else other than that in that particular category. Another favorite example is the diagnostic category of pedophilia. That is, the individual has a compulsion to molest children. You look at the diagnostic criteria for pedophilia in the DSM, they're very close to simply describing a child molester. So, indeed, the American Psychiatric Association some years ago came out and said, yes, pedophilia is a mental disorder, and it's a criminal behavior. So this sort of confusion and muddling is still very much at work in our field. And hopefully, my book, I'm hoping to sort of help clarify some of this. The third point is we have social systems now that are built around what, again, sociologists call regulating criminal deviance. In the history, back in Dickensian England, we had urchins. Today we have, and then in the 50s, we had juvenile delinquents. And today we have kids with conduct disorder. No, seriously.
conduct disorder. That's
good. Now, where are... We can't make up our minds, I mean collectively, all of us, not just psychiatry and criminal law, we can't make up our minds how we want to take care of people and how we want to address problematic deviance in our society. I bet you some of you know what the biggest mental health facility in Dallas County is. Lou Sterrett Justice Center, by far. More mentally ill people that are cared for in jail than there are anywhere else in Dallas County. We have mentally retarded individuals in jail. We have juvenile delinquents who have schizophrenia. We have homeless individuals that have mental illness, and we have homeless individuals that don't have mental illness. We don't know what to do with these people, and so oftentimes these people circulate from setting to setting, criminal justice, rehabilitation, psychiatric hospitals, juvenile detention. They circulate around. There's no cohesion. We don't know what's going on. And again, I think there's a relationship, again, between these contrasting folk metaphysics. On the one hand, we want to blame deviants for their freely chosen behavior. On the other hand, we want to excuse them because they're simply products of complex, multi-causal, inter-level determinants. D, the last one, psychiatrists complain that mental illness is stigmatized. We whine all the time that, you know, just people who are mentally ill, they're sick like everybody else. Please respect us. That's generally true. On the other hand, we have these categories that are frankly have to do with wrongful and criminal conduct. So we can't have it both ways, I don't think. So that concludes my talk. I would love to hear from y'all. Thank you, sir.
Good answer for that. 10 minutes of questions, and please keep your comments short. If you start talking for more than a minute or two, I'm going to come around and start tickling you. So, who'd like to start?
Oh. I just have one burning question. First of all, I'm intensely interested in your topic. Recently, I picked up a book called The Sociopath Next Door. I don't know if you've heard of it,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It probably is a little beneath real scholarly work, but in any case, it really raised a question in my mind, and I was sort of wondering what your thoughts were on that particular subject of sociopaths.
Okay. Everybody heard the question. Mm-hmm. I think, I can't tell you for sure where I'm going to come down on all this stuff. When I started out working on my Vice book, I basically had the attitude going in that psychiatry needs to get out of the moral realm. Okay? And it was the category of sociopathy and the other related concept of psychopathy. How many of you have seen the movie Wall Street with Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko, the guy who says greed is good? So Gordon Gekko is a great example of what we would call a socialized psychopath. I can talk about Gordon Gekko, but he's a fictional character. He's a socialized psychopath, which means he really has no guilt. He exploits others without remorse. He is purely self-interested. And he understands the difference between right and wrong, but he doesn't care. And that's what psychopathy is. So these are people, and so what's interesting about psychopaths, and this is a very hot area in my field of philosophy of psychiatry in terms of argument, is there are some people who believe that psychopaths should be excused as mentally ill like everyone else because they have this incapability of what moral philosophers call other regarding moral beliefs. That is that if I accidentally hurt you, even if it wasn't intentional, I would feel bad, right? Psychopaths don't feel that way. They accidentally hurt you, they know that I could get in trouble for this, but they don't care. All right? So on the one hand, there's a group of moral philosophers that say these people are mentally ill, they need to be excused, like someone that had schizophrenia and that thinks, you know, that's hearing voices telling them to kill their children. Okay. The other side of the argument is comes from actually one of the primary theorists of psychopathy, this guy, a psychologist named Robert Hare. And Hare says, what you need in the criminal justice system is culpability, that is blameworthiness. And so if this guy knows that killing his children is against the law, that's good enough. The fact that he doesn't care doesn't matter. And so these people are arguing with each other. Now, the other comment that I have for your question is the psychopath next door suggests, you know, these people are lurking everywhere. First of all, they're not lurking everywhere, although they are out there. And I chose the Gordon Gekko character purposefully because here's a person who is successful, at least by some measures, right? But he has really these pretty serious impairments in his, what I would call his moral capacity. So one of the distinctions I'm making in my book is between moral contents and moral capacities. And so the person who has a moral capacity has this ability to feel and act in regards to others' experiences. I can empathize with them and understand their position. And if I accidentally harm them, I feel badly. That's a person with intact moral capacity. Psychopaths, according to Sadler, don't have intact moral capacity. The other interesting question about moral contents is particularly kinds of moral beliefs. And this is a question that's interesting. One of the questions at one of my professional meetings are terrorists, you know, like Islamic radical terrorists, do they have a mental illness?
And there was some discussion about that. And my viewpoint is the answer is no, because they have their motivations for their behavior are ideological, that is, their moral contents, in particular moral themes. They're not the ability to act. They have the capacity to relate morally, and you know that by the way they relate to their comrades, that they're loyal to them, they love their children, they respect their wives, and so forth and so on.
Next question.
Yeah.
Just springboard a little bit off that idea of someone who's functionally mentally ill. They commit a crime and it goes to court. And then all of a sudden you have, okay, he's a functional, and I think you probably answered the question, but okay, he's functional, he knows it was wrong.
So we're talking about a psychopathic
illness? Yeah, or a schizophrenic.
A person with a psychotic illness.
Yeah.
There is mental illness.
So I guess my question is there a clear-cut line between functional and non-functional, and I'm giving a look at your face, I'm guessing there's not, between, okay, is this person functional, is it not functional, is there a set standard of what is functional, what is not functional, can you do that in those cases?
So how do you make the call between someone who should be excused because of mental illness and someone who shouldn't be? Is that fair?
That's the gist. Of what I'm getting at.
Let me just explain. There's a certain mythology about the insanity defense that has to be debunked here. Anyone care to guess what percent of murder cases use the insanity defense? Anyone care to say
5%?
Huh?
5%.
Right number?
All of them.
I got 5%, 90%. Anyone else?
30%.
30. It's 0.5%. It's very uncommon. And of those, they're rarely successful. What are the ones you hear about? The ones, the successful cases, that are controversial. And so your popular understanding of the function of the insanity defense is based on media coverage of the interesting cases and not necessarily the ordinary case. So that's the first thing. So to answer your question, how difficult is it? Generally speaking, it's not very hard because defense attorneys almost never want to invoke the insanity defense because it almost always fails. So, they don't need psychiatrists to make that call for them, and this decision is made long before they even would call a forensic expert. They call the forensic expert when they think they have a credible case. And so, the classic example in Texas is the Andrea Yates case, the woman who had a postpartum psychotic illness and killed her kids in a delusional state, thinking that she was protecting them from Satan or something related. Have I answered your question?
Yes.
Time for one last question.
We all know that there are genetic, neurochemical, endocrinological bases for personality changes, cortical defects, prefrontal cortical defects, temporal lobe epilepsy, Huntington's disease, in which there's schizotypal personalities. They have personality disorders, and they may create commit a crime. But premenstrual syndrome, for example, endocrinological again. But if the court says, this is determined because of an organic problem, isn't this a slippery slope then for the law?
Yeah. So the question is,
if they give criminal excuse because of a
organic
cause, a physical cause, a biological cause, to make it very simple, isn't that a slippery slope? Yes. And so what you have to understand, go back to the adversary system, and what criminal attorneys want to do is they want to play, particularly defense attorneys, want to play upon confusion of the jury and to introduce reasonable doubt. Okay? And so the idea is that if you introduce in these biochemical explanations of behavior, that's going to introduce, so it's strategy. So the question is, if we go back to Morse, we have to answer two questions. So was the patient rational at the time of the act? Yes or no? And was the patient facing a hard choice? Yes or no? If you can answer those questions, in the negative for both, then the defendant is responsible. But defense lawyers want to muddy the waters by doing the dance between what I'm calling these two folk metaphysical positions. And criminal attorneys do this, the prosecutors do the same thing, just in the opposite direction. So the whole notion of neuroscience explanations of behavior, is that going to screw up criminal law? No more than it's already screwed up. It's because it's a tactical way of introducing reasonable doubt when the defense wants to obscure the question of rationality and hard choice.
What's the title of the book?
Well, it's not out yet. It will be titled Vice and Psychiatric Diagnosis.
Very good. Let's give a round of applause for that. Thanks everyone for coming out. And in 2 weeks, we'll have the 2005 Texas Poet Laureate that's going to be here talking about the philosophy of perception. So we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Excuse me.